And I'm going to talk to you about this acronym and what it means, the difference of SMEFT and what some people call HEFT, and what those two things are, and why actually a non-trivial amount of people are working on these sorts of things, considering what we've known so far at LHC. So I already discussed this, let me skip that. So the basic thing I'm going to try and get across is, first of all, pictorially, what we seem to know about this Higgs-like scalar in an EFT context, and I'll explain what I mean by this acronym. Sometimes it's even called the linear standard model effective field theory, which is kind of a double misnomer. And I'll talk to you about this HEFT thing, which is a bit of a different theory. And why would you want to think about these things beyond leading order is one of the things I'll get to at the end of the talk. So if you want to tell these different field theories apart, one thing you want to do is understand what the data says about these possible field theories of interpreting the data, not just LHC data. So we have a global fit making that effort in what is the SMEFT. It's now at 177 observables as a couple weeks ago. So I'll show you that, and that actually motivates why you want to also go beyond tree level in some cases. So there's a lot of reasons to go beyond tree level, which I'll get through in the talk, and I'll also show you how, in particular, how when you actually do a particular calculation at one loop, Higgs decay to gamma gamma, in this sort of theory, it affects what you're going to conclude. So this we did last year in the summer, but it's a very nice result of a former graduate student of mine. And it's really, I think, kind of blazing a path in the jungle of these next leading order calculations. And there's a lot more calculations you'll see coming out now this last year in a sort of way. But we weren't the first people to do this sort of thing, which I'll mention at the end.
You're not going to talk about the iPhoton.
750?
Yeah.
Okay. So, it's
you heard it first year. So
we wrote one paper basically taking that hint and projecting it into this formalism. And the order one lesson is that, let's kind of put this, that you basically have to turn off this operator. If you had a scalar state, you have this relevant operator because it has to decay. There's a cutoff scale here generically, which is fake. Mm. And you have to make this 10 to the minus 2 to deal with Higgs data. So we did that. I'm not going to talk about it. But that's the order one lesson of that thing, which is already going well.
10 minus 2 what?
So 10 to the minus 2, units of the.
So you have to basically make a loop suppression happen here. But that can happen. But let's not get into that, because that's not what we're talking about. So this is a little more we're talking about. So this is something that actually exists, this Higgs-like boson. And I take that pretty seriously. And this is pictorially representing to you what happened in run one in terms of how we were learning about its properties. So what this is a rescaling of the fermionic couplings of the 0 plus scalar, assuming it's a 0 plus scalar, letting that flow from the standard model value normalize the standard model to 1. And this is the same thing, but you universally float the vector boson couplings to the 0 plus scalar. And the reason you do this is this is a way of pictorially not doing the most general thing, but of doing something which actually has a well-defined way of deviating from the standard model and seeing, is the data globally selecting for the standard model point? Is it actually falling into that as a preferred solution in the data? And that's 1-1, and you can see, yes, indeed, it is indeed converging on that point. So what that means from a broad perspective is that this scalar has properties very close to the standard model Higgs boson. And the consequence of that is that there's it seems the order one lesson from that is that there's a decoupling going on for the effects of physics beyond the standard model, that this scalar is at least playing the role of pushing the unitarity problems of the standard model with spin one vector bosons out to higher scales than it would be if you didn't have this scalar alone. So I'll come back to that in a second. But another way of representing the same information is on this other plot, which is a log-log plot. So I don't know if you know Feynman's dictum of log-log plots? Okay, if you don't, then I'm not going to tell you in public, but log-log plots, yeah, it's semi-public. No, it's dirtier than that. It's a Feynman quote. So anyways, I'll tell you later. But the point is that log-log plots, this is another way of representing information. It's a little bit different version of this information. But there's a line on here, which is the standard model expectation, and there's the line, which is what we see in terms of these deviations, or possible deviations in terms of the couplings of the things like boson to the standard model states. Now, the important point is if you looked at this, it's a line over a log-log plot. So you might think, wow, this is really strongly selecting for the standard model. But really, because of the reasoning I was just telling you of what that other plot means, if you were to think about what sort of deviations you could get reasonably so that the cutoff scale theory remained pushed away from the electroweak scale, it shouldn't be that you would have a random line on this plot. You should have possibly deviations which could be bigger down here, sort of like fermions, and smaller for the massive states. So that's because the dependence for the standard model on these couplings is not random, because this scalar has a job in the standard model. It is to restore unitarity and to let this theory be extrapolated to very high energy scales. And so whenever you have a possible deviation from the standard model or a different scenario, which happens to have a zero plus scalar in the spectrum, it can't just arbitrarily mess with those couplings without dropping the cutoff scale back on top of the mass scale of the W and Z. So the gray region is just this. So let me put a little. So this is not a precise region, it's just schematic. But what this means is what I'm just about to get to, which is that, okay, so you put a zero plus scalar on the spectrum, even if it's not exactly the standard model Higgs, you normalize it to the standard model couplings just for the sake of normalizing sort of this is one. And then you have these amplitudes in the usual scattering that is the problem in the standard model. Even if it's not exactly the standard model Higgs, as long as you put a zero plus scalar in the spectrum, it leads to a correction term like this, which softens this amplitude so long as A is near standard model values. And similarly, if you have scattering of fermions into longitudinal components of vectors, then you have the same story, but you have the mass scale of the fermion that comes in. And because the mass scale of the fermion comes in, you could have larger separations here and still have a parametric separation from the mass scale of the spin one vector bosons you're trying to deal with, then you would get in terms of things like just the W and Z pair coupling. Simply because this is a small coupling. So this leads to a unitary problem which is pushed to a little bit of a higher scale.
So the gray area is supposed to be the range of uncertainty in A I could have had?
No. The gray area is just to give you an idea that if you were to think about deviations, what sort of deviations could you find where you would still have a cutoff scale which is being pushed away from the electroweak scale. And it's just it's just schematically showing you can have larger sort of deviations in terms of these like fermionic couplings than you can for the massive. Well, the point is you could have larger deviations here, and you would still have the small coupling. So the cutoff scale of the theory would still be.
So if I start the range of A that I could get from the experimental limit, then you say that's how the gray area is that range of A.
It is not a precise statement. It is simply to give you an idea that here are not yet. Yeah, but schematically that's what I'm trying to say. Was that you might think that people who are looking at large deviations in these very light power couplings are just wasting their time. But actually, you could have larger deviations there for these sort of reasons, and not mess with the cutoff scale too bad. Anyways, I have a lot of slides, and this is slide 2C, which was basically making this point. And the standard model case is just the Higgs, which is an exact solution to this problem, where if the coupling came on a particular value, it's maybe a coupled or normalized version of this physics, where this is exactly canceled, right? So, but it could be that you either have perturbations on the Higgs properties, or it could be you have this scalar in the spectrum, and this sort of decoupling pushing the cutoff scale away and still happen. So this is 2C for the slide, and just asking questions. So it's probably not going to make you happy for me to say I have 60 slides. But
don't worry. They don't all go to C. It's okay.
We can't promise we're going to be here for them all.
That might not be a comforting statement, but let's move on. But anyways, this is just this kind of argument. This is just a rough way to think about it. I just wanted to get this across, that we do know that these scales exist, and we think, considering the overall story from run one, that that scalar is in the spectrum. It's not there with couplings that are random, and it is pushing the cutoff of the theory away from the electroweak scale. But there is a cutoff, and the question is, where is the cutoff? Is it going all the way up to the Planck scale or being extrapolated to very high scales like the standard model Higgs? Or is it in this intermediate regime where it possibly can also solve other problems we have with us and the problems of our physics? I think it's there. The question is not, in my mind, how far there is a cutoff. What, if there's a cutoff scale or not, it's where it is. That's the question. So if you think that way, then you want to think bottom up. You want to write down field theories that have a cutoff scale in them. You want to have things with a limited regime of validity. You don't want to just stick with the standard model. And so what can you do? So there's two things you can do, broadly speaking. And three people in this room have I think, realized this idea over the years. That's kind of an amusing thing. So this is one thing you can do. And Maxim, you might remember when we first met, or I was talking, this is the theory I was talking about, the talk I gave. You probably don't care, you don't remember. But it's true. But that was about this work with Ben and I when we actually met this problem. But I didn't know at the time that you had already kind of, you know, had vague ideas like this with Cliff, if you look at your paper from 99. Because it's basically stated there.
I remember that.
Yeah,
I remember that.
So the point is, okay, anyways, it's a long story. But anyways, I'm sad to say it's not just you guys, not just us that have kind of stumbled on this. There's other people in the early 90s that also stumbled on it. But I think the latter papers on that list, I think, are clear statements that this is a real different EFT from a bottom-up point of view. That's fair to say. Anyways, what you can do is this, and I'm not going to talk mostly about this. This is not SMEFT, this is HEFT, as you'll see. But what you could do is just you take the goldstones that you know are there because you have massive spin one states, you write them down in a sigma field. You now have a zero plus scalar in the spectrum, or something you assume is dominantly zero plus. You write down this H field. You take the standard model with massive spin one boson, the massive fermions, and then you add all possible interactions involving the state. So this is the obvious bottom-up point thing to do, to write down all possible couplings allowed by the symmetry. It's following the EFT mantra. And this is not just a vacuous thing. It's a very general formalism that motivates you doing rescalings of standard model couplings like I showed you in those kappa fits. This is actually used, this is the theoretical underpinning of what is reported in the experiments with those kappa fits. This is actually
pi?
Where pi? You mean
sigma is pi
A. Although that's the goldstone. That's the goldstone Z, W, and Z. There's three of those. So you know you have massive W's and Z's.
Right.
So you just, this is a non-linear realization of the gauge symmetry. So you just write down massive W's and Z's. You put down the goldstones explicitly. And this term, when you expand it out, just gives mass up to the W and Z. So this is the bottom-up, simple, stupid thing to do, right? So, and that's why people keep meeting it over the years. And after us, there was also people that met it later, and they think they were the first people to meet it, but so it's such as it is. Anyway, so like I said, this is used in the data analysis, and but this is under active development, basically outside of North America. I don't know why, but for some reason, people in North America aren't working on this. But it is being very rapidly developed, mostly in Munich and Madrid, by these guys. They developed a subdating version of this theory in operator basis. People are exploring how, when you do composite case models, you match and how this theory looks in those matchings. There's a very vigorous power kind of discussion, which I don't want to get into, but there's also a real distinction between this theory and the theory I'm going to mostly talk about in terms of Hilbert definition of invariant distinction, in terms of this theory and its scalar manifold properties, the curvature of the properties of the scalar manifold, by distinguishing it in the Hilbert definition of invariant way from SMEFT. So I just wanted to say that this is actually going on, this is actually an interesting theory to think about, which is, in some sense, a thing that can be wrong, because we're just doing everything bottom-up and putting all possible options there. However, it could be this is an overly generous formalism, in the sense that you could have relationships between these couplings when you have the Higgs assumed to be in an SQ scalar domain. And that's the SMEFT. So the SMEFT thing is when you you basically take this Lagrangian and you have the standard model's first term. That's good science. It seems to work well. So you're assuming now that there's the Landau-Ginzburg theory giving you the potential of the Higgs, and then you get the spontaneous breaking it has in the standard model. Then you write down the dimension 5 operator, like the Weinberg operator. Then you write down dimension 7, dimension 6 operators, so just go to 10. So one thing I want to get across is this sort of thing, thinking about either of these theories, is interesting in and of itself to just study the structure of the theory. So one thing that's an example of that is it's not an accident that the odd powers of these operators actually violate Lepton number. You can actually understand that from a counting argument in terms of the dimensions of the fields, and you can see that these people have shown this in this appendix. So there's global symmetry structure in here as well, and we're going to have to use some of that global symmetry structure to go to a very symmetric limit of these general EFTs because there's a lot of parameters. But that's something that you can actually understand why that structure is there. And it's interesting to study these theories in and of themselves. So this one, the baryon number violating operator 7-6, we're going to have to neglect because they have to be very small. But that's a reasonable thing to do because it's a real constraint on some estimators, experimentally motivated. So it's interesting, to me at least, how if you look at the development of this theory and thinking in this way, you can see the field looking away from this approach in the early 80s, hoping that there would be some complicated Suzy sector or something that we would just discover, with mass scales very close to the W and Z. And now that we find a zero plus scalar on the spectrum, people are now looking back and you can see that this is undergoing a lot of development. So it's just interesting to look at the timeline of this. This is particularly interesting to me. It took to 2010 for a minimal non-redundant basis of this form to be sorted out. The algorithm these guys did, this is Misiak and collaborators, I'm actually pronouncing that wrong, Misiak. This is called the Warsaw basis. And that algorithm has then led to further developments involving Lehman and Martin and Murayama and Henning and such at Berkeley, where they basically now have solved the problem of going out to higher orders. They have the algorithm that you can actually just use to define the operator basis order by order. So again, at least I think it's interesting to study these theories in and of themselves. And there's a lot of parameters.
The binary 79 out of Y's 1080, wasn't there also a look check and see?
There might have been.
Do you agree with this, by the way? Because people have said that this is not the version of the
I was surprised that was not the same as the one we were
so apparently he made some claim in the comments. I thought you both talked about it. But and apparently it's invalid. But a lot of operators, a lot of parameters. But I want to get across that it's not a disaster. So one thing is when you see all these parameters, you might just run for the hills. So maybe this is maybe run for the hills. This standard model has 18 or 19 with this strong CP problem. You add the neutrino masses of mixing, you get some extra parameters, but then you go to dimension 6, and then you get...
What do you mean by strong CP? I thought there was only
one theta parameter. It's the embedded sharp parameter.
What's that?
I just mean the theta parameter. You can add that.
Oh, yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Not 19 strong CP parameters.
No, I mean just add one.
Okay.
18 plus one for that.
That's good. That's my
yeah, no, that would be worse. But look, if you want parameters, here's your parameters. Okay, so at dimension 6, it turns out if you do the counting, we actually did this counting in this highly used niche actually to sort this out. How many parameters do you get? That's 2,499 for three generations of dimension 6. And it actually breaks into CP even in CP off this way. And that's kind of a famous number now, but the thing is, it's almost all the fermion indices. So if you look at one generation, it's down to 76, and if you go one generation and motivate to neglect CP odd corrections, then you're down to 53. So it's not as bad as you would think if you have a well-motivated symmetry assumption to get down into that region, and we actually do have that, which is MFV, which people know I'm very excited about.
What is MFV?
Yep, minimal flare violation. So. Let me get to that in a second. But CP even, get rid of those. Minimal flare violation, which means basically you have a flavor symmetry which is only broken by the standard model of Yukawa's because that's experimentally consistent with the data set that we have so far. It's a reasonable assumption you can make. And you get down to 53 parameters. So it's actually a lot, but it's not ridiculously too many so that we're completely sunk from day one as to the number of parameters. So the complexity is scaling up, and there's even more once you go to dimension 8, it goes up tremendously, but there's another thing that helps you, which allows you to actually say, with straight face, we can actually do the relevant general case. And the reason is that not all these parameters are made equal, they're equal from the power counting perspective, but when you actually think about how you measure things at colliders, when you make precise measurements at colliders, you don't just sit there with some continuum background, right? It's not something that you have to compete against soft QCD to make a precise measurement. You have something where you have the kinematic signature, which has some initial and final states, which distinguish it from the background. And those things go through the light standard model states, and there's pole structures, there's resonant features that you're always using. And when you're actually using resonances to actually get more precise measurements at colliders, you have the fact that these intermediate states have widths, and then you have interference with the four fermion operators compared to the operators that change vertex corrections, and you get relative scalings in terms of there's a width suppression of a four fermion operator interfering with something which has a resonance pole exchange compared to the case where you're just looking at the shift in the vertex correction. So that helps you with another 25 or so parameters, so it gets you down to a reasonable number of parameters you can do. So we can really do this relevant general case. You can do more restrictive things, but you don't need to do it in order to do this. You can actually do a program of actually trying to use this flavor symmetry and CP even assumption, and then do the general case. So
can I ask,
yeah.
So this neglecting CP violation, is there an easy way that to see that? I mean, wouldn't they regenerate the quantum correction of the CP violation?
Well, if you assume that there's a symmetry that's suppressing, then they'll be preserving the corrections. But you listen to people like Maxim who EDMs, and you basically say experimentally, it looks like a good assumption to impose. It's a symmetry, it's almost symmetry. There's CP violation in the standard model, but that's very small. That'll come in proportional to the Yarrow's Cobb invariant. So that'll come in really small because it'll be proportional to the Yarrow's Cobb invariant. So that'll be the invariant of the standard model that defines CP violation in the standard model.
You need to involve three generations and the loops. And
that's the smartest thing.
So that's a reasonable assumption to make. It's experimentally motivated. So we start with the general case, and then we stick with the subset that seems to be experimentally. So if we were to find deviations and use this framework to understand them, you want it consistent with the global measurement picture that we already have. And this is why we're doing these assumptions. So it's not that bad, but it is still a lot. So let me just try and get you a little bit oriented. So this, you can have operators like this that just have field strengths. You can have derivatives acting on Higgs fields. The Higgs fields for these biases are phi. You have redefinitions of Yukawa couplings. You have field strengths with H dagger H. And then you have dipole operators. This violates chirality. So this should be proportional with small fermion masses and can be neglected also for symmetry assumption we're using. And then you have Hermitian derivatives acting on Higgs fields with fermions. This gives you new Z couplings to fermions and W couplings. But that's basically what you get. And then you have four fermion operators. Now, again, I told you that almost all the parameters are here. You can see it again. There's all these flavor indices. So 3 times 3 times 3 times 3 is 81. And then there's 25. So that's 2,205. It's not exactly that counting, but it gives you an idea that almost all the parameters are in there. And there's another 25 of these. So if we're using resonances to extract detailed information, that gets things under control a little bit lower than that 53 number. So that's the picture. The picture is this. You have, this is the SMEFT. You have the standard model as a pointing theory space. You know that from, globally speaking, the measurements we're making, the cutoff scale is rising above the electroweak scale, and especially in terms of the 0 plus scalar. Bromodid HLE has pushed us into this sort of thing. Run 2 will probably push us a little closer to the standard model. But we have possible deviations, a whole pattern of possible deviations that could happen when you write down these higher dimensional operators with different Wilson coefficients in the linear case. This other theory I talked about at the start, the Heft, has also possible deviations. But this one is a little more general than this one. In this sense, you can see at lower orders in the power counting, you're associating the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs. So you're associating Higgs and non-Higgs set of Green's functions. In this case, which is not generally the case here. So there's a more general way of parameterizing possible deviations. The hope is we'll see deviations, there'll be some pattern, we want to be able to distinguish these things going forward. That's why we want to understand globally what the pattern of allowed deviations are in this somewhat more restricted formula.
Question. Is there a reason you're not centered, these are not centered around this kind of model?
Just a pictorial representation of how they both have a decoupling limit to the standard model, but the decoupling limit isn't exactly the same.
Are you implying that there's a different direction that you could go where it's not described by EFT?
You're describing on the boundary.
It's simply a Venn diagram. It's a bad Venn diagram. But I'm just trying to say that you limit to the standard model point and the decoupling regime and all these theories. But exactly the pattern deviations you find does not have to be the same. So you want to understand what's experimentally allowed in the more restricted case to try and distinguish. Keep your eyes open if you actually start to see deviations, whether you should use one formula versus another. Even if you find a couple of resonances, it's still not going to be obvious what the full UV theory is that invents this scalar. Right? So you basically want to be able to study both cases. And both cases are under development in different groups. So if you want to put this together globally, then you have to put together lots of information from lots of different energy scales. And so you have to put together low energy measurements, for example, all the EVMs or very flavor-changing measurements. There's preferred symmetry assumptions that you can actually get pushed into when you think about that, like MPD. Or you just assume CP even in this case. There's also lots of colliders, tens of GEDs from the 80s and 90s that you probably haven't heard of, but they existed, Tristan and Petrum and such. And you can use that data. There's the LEP C-pole measurements, which are wonderful. The Higgs pole is now going to be strongly explored in Run 2. And then LEP 2, we have measurements such as the double W production, which I'll get to in a second. And LHC measures a lot of things with a lot of different channels, with a lot of different poles in the standard models. There's a ton of information, which projects onto this space of possible deviations in some more constrained and less constrained directions with these vectors and Wilson coefficients. But since you want to put together globally the whole picture, maybe just a bit perverse, but I actually think it's important to do because these are definitions, you want to combine these vectors measured at very different scales in a consistent way.
Now, these vectors only rotate a little bit when you put them together, but the point is also that you have strong hierarchies and measurement sensitivity for different experiments. So those small changes can actually make a big difference in what you're interpreting in terms of possible deviations. So this is the name of the game. So let me just show you the state of play of these sorts of global analyses, why they motivate some of these calculations beyond leading order. So some of the best measurements around are LEP1 pseudo-observables, which are given here. So you have things like the Z-mass, which you use as an input, then the W-mass, and the total width, the Z. These are ratios, like the Z left conic decay versus the total width, and these are four backwardated symmetries involving E plus and minus to different quantum state fermions.
W-mass is probably what happened, right?
No, this is not just that. So this is a very question.
They did measure it in LEP2, but it's actually much better. I'll get to that in a second at the Tevatron. Fair enough. But the point is, if you look at the errors here, the experimental errors, and you look at the theoretical errors in the standard model, where this is the field theory you assume interpreting these measurements, you'll notice that these errors are always smaller than these errors. That's because theorists did their job, and they basically wanted to get maximum benefit from these measurements, and they calculated until the point where the experimental error was dominant over theoretical error, and then their friends told them to stop doing that, because it's kind of pointless, because this is just a bigger error. And some listened and some didn't, but essentially eventually it died out, right? So there's two loop calculations in the standard model here. But the point is, that is a different field theory than the field theory I want to interpret the data in, and other people want to interpret the data in. This standard model effective field theory has a cutoff scale, and that is the thing that's important to realize, is these are real field theories. These are not scenarios, they're not kind of sort of games. These are real field theories that have their own theoretical errors. And you have to think about, do we need to develop these theories beyond leading order in order to interpret this data robustly? And the answer is basically yes. So let's take a look at why. So one way you can interpret this data, a large set of this data, is the traditional STU paradigm. So that the students know, if you don't know, let me just remind you, what that was is basically pre the discovery of this scalar, people figured out that a smart thing to do is if you were to assume that the physics was dominantly in these two-point functions and small in these vertex corrections, then you could talk about how all those shifts in those two-point functions affected all those observables and do global fits of that form, parameterize it with a couple of parameters. This one actually turned out to be smaller. And then you could just look at what is preferred in that plane. And then you could actually do a calculation involving the Higgs, which is consistent with those assumptions, and then you could see where you wanted to sit in that plane. And if you thought about physics beyond the standard model, according to those assumptions, you had to be consistent with that.
So what was STU?
That's STU.
What is this?
S and T are combinations of two-point functions, differences of two-point functions at Q squared equals MZ and Q squared equals zero, which is exactly this. So you basically build up these combinations of two-point functions in order to parameterize these possible shifts.
So that is something which has an assumption of small new physics effects in the vertex corrections bigger in the two-point function, which is not actually Clüver definition invariant, but it is consistent with the UV, which was very highly mobile, which is the Higgs. That's why it was a reasonable thing to do. But now that we've found the Higgs-like scalar and want to use this data, we have if we assume this SMEC thing, then we have the Higgs in there, that's the dominant part of these contributions, and the sub-dominant piece, the remaining perturbations on the vertex corrections versus remaining subdominant perturbation corrections. Two-point functions, it won't necessarily have that hierarchy. So we want to do a more general thing than just the traditional STU approach for that reason. So that's what you and other people do as well. And I have a very hard-working graduate student, Laura, who's going to graduate as well, actually early next year. And last summer, we're up to 103 observables, including LAP data. So this is some other low-energy data. And then we have lower precision measurements. We think we understood your paper on neutrino trident production, so we included that, but you should look to see if it actually was right. Universality of data decays, just basically everything we could actually incorporate easily in this map. We've done that last year. And this global data analysis is 103 observables, including LEP1. And you learn things like this. Okay, so with that data set, these are vertex shifts for certain couplings of the Z. If you had the theoretical error of this theory, which is not the standard model with the cutoff scale and higher dimensional operators, had zero theoretical error, then you would be sitting in this very small region here, and you're getting the maximum benefit from the measurement. But if this theoretical error is 0.3%, say, or 1%, which is due to neglected, say, dimension 8 operators or perturbative corrections in this formalism, you can see you're losing the benefit of the measurement. because you don't have the theoretical error sub-dominant experimental error. This relaxing what you're losing, what you conclude. It also affects your subspace correlations and constraints. You can see this thing starts to tilt. So you can be pushed in the wrong direction.
So that's bad. So we want to deal with that by improving this theory.
Now, even to show you that, 103 observables seems like a lot, but it's still not enough. It's actually amazing, but you actually have to include these triple gauge coupling measurements, or more properly, E plus C minus before fermion measurements, to actually close the black directions that were still there in that data set. What we were doing is closing them with just assuming the power kind of the theory, because that's the consistent thing to do, but we want to robustly close them now with the actual measurements. That's what we did a couple of weeks ago. So there you have to do a full calculation of E plus C minus before fermions. And again, there's an issue because the field redefinitions can move you from having new physics effects in vertex correction into here. If you want to robustly close down in a basis independent way of possible deviations, including this fact, you want to do this calculation. So that's been done. The details are in the paper. I'll just show you some pictures. The point that is kind of appreciated in the literature before us, but is something I want to reemphasize here, is that until you actually close this down in this left two data in a legitimate way and self-consistent calculation, you don't learn that much globally in the general case where you can have all possible correlations and all possible cancellations between parameters in this generalization of the standard model. These vertex corrections at left, which is just the upper part here, are highly correlated. This is a heat map of the correlations between these Wilson coefficients. There's 20 of them. This is the one that involves triple gauge coupling measurements, or the WWW operator. And this is the vertex corrections, how they are correlated. This is quite dramatic. And this is 1 minus 1 in the correlation space. So if you were to make UV assumptions about how the parameters here can be in some UV theory, you'll have a huge effect on the fit you do generally once you start reducing down, profiling down to smaller number of parameters in the fit space. Or if you do something sloppy for this kind of hard to calculate process, which is 2 to 4 fermion scattering, because it's off shell and it's non-resonant, so it's a bit difficult to do in field theory, then you can also have a huge effect on your conclusion. And that's why if you look at the data and you look at people's conclusions over the years, people disagree, and partially because usually they made a UV assumption like this, they thought it wouldn't make a big effect, they had a huge effect, or they were a little bit sloppy and that caused some trouble.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah.
So how did you get this plot? So do you do a Monte Carlo Markov chain in this?
No, this is, we do the analysis with the 20 parameters in terms of all of these data sets. We consistently calculate 177 observables with all of these parameters,
And
then we fit it, and then we look at the correlation matrix for the chi-squared fit that we get, and this is the correlation matrix represented visually to you as to what's correlated and what isn't correlated.
But I mean, okay, so
for instance, we're not assuming any value for the Wilson coefficients. So this is the correlations and the minimum is
the problem is where you do have degeneracies, that means that you don't really have, I mean, there could be lots of parameters that give the same fit.
Yeah.
Right.
That's true. Yeah.
So
that's correct.
So then you, the Fisher matrix kind of loses its meaning.
I think it's still well defined. Because I think we still at leading order in the shifts, we have a well defined Fisher information matrix.
But no,
I agree with you that there are lots of combinations of parameters that can give the same.
So why don't you try to do a MCMC search in the parameter space?
I'm not saying that you can't do that, but that's not what we did. So, and I think what we did is well defined. I'm not sure what the preference, why there would be a preference to doing that. Maybe there's a reason that you can explain, but I don't know what would be better about that.
No, the reason I'm saying is, so what's the point of Fisher? If you take your chi-square and expand it around its minimum, right?
Yeah.
But if the leading candidate expansion vanishes, then you have to go to the next order, and that's what that means, right? Whenever there's degeneracy, that means the sum of the eigenvalues of the Fisher matrix are zero. So that means that.
No, we don't have we have non-zero eigenvalues.
But you do have zero eigenvalues as well.
I actually have the eigenvalue system. I could show you, but it's not on these slides. I can show you after. So we've actually done the eigenvalue analysis of the system itself. But let me postpone that. Let me show you that in a minute. But I'd be interested to know if you could do something more, because it's one of the problems with this. What do you do? I mean, you just have this large number of parameters, and that's just the way it is. This is the general case, but we'd like to be able to use it more.
As much as I'm actually doing this MCMC, is really what I
Okay, well, let's discuss that in a minute, because I'd like to know what that gains us. Because if it does gain us something, then I'd like to actually learn that. But the key, as I said, was to calculate these 2 to 4 fermion scatterings, and that's what we've now done. Again, some hardworking graduate students are listed there. And there's a subtlety here, if you know that there's this subtlety in terms of defining off-shell states of decay in quantum field theory. You have to be a bit careful about that. There's no unique prescription in the field theory. People know that the solution, in terms of the standard model, the solution, the well-defined way to do a gauge invariant thing is to essentially expand around the poles, and they do a Lorentz expansion around the physical poles in the process. Then because you, in principle, could go to a measurement where you took the values of S12 and S34, which took on particular values, this should be a gauge invariant residue of this amplitude. So you can do this, what's called the doubly resonant approximation, and this is what people did to design the codes that people used at Lab 2 to analyze the data. And, then they did perturbative corrections on this in a well-defined way. And it just basically organizes the calculation around the poles, the physical poles in the process. But there's not a, this has a matching up just to the Feynman diagrams that are doubly resonant. But then there's combinations of doubly resonant and singly resonant diagrams in these pieces. So it's not exactly a one-to-one mapping of Feynman diagrams. It's a reorganization of the theory around its poles. But it's you need to do an EFT to do this and to mock up this sort of calculation and do the EFT consistently. It's taking into account the fact that you have a bunch of Lagrangian parameters now that include shifts of the mass, the physical mass, compared to the terms that are in the Lagrangian just in the standard model. And you have to include those shifts, which also depend on these higher dimensional operators. But you can do that, and that's what we did. But people hadn't done that before, somewhat surprisingly. Then we fixed this to the physical poles, including these corrections, and then we just can calculate the thing consistently. And when you do that, you get this sort of sensitivity for this important set of data to close down these flat directions. You get these are curves of how you get shift as a function of square root of s for things that are shifting the off-shell triple gauge coupling vertex. And these are things that aren't doing that. They're shifting the mass of the W, the shift in the width of the W, or the vertex corrections of the W and Z to the fermions. Now you'll notice the scale here is bigger than this. And so if you do UV or you do assumptions in your analysis, you just set this to zero, that's pretty dangerous, considering it's much bigger. But it actually numerically isn't that bad. We've been able to study that exactly now. But it's better to just do the general case and just do the fit. That's what we did. And you also have the angular information, which is also just given here about how you look at sensitivity. Anyways, at the end of the day, you combine all that, and then you close down all flat directions. And then you can profile down to just one parameter at a time to see what you get, considering the other parameters could be picking on all possible values. You have a bunch of Wilson coefficients. It doesn't really matter in particular what these values are, but just to give you an idea of what sort of things happen, if you go multiply by 100 times the Wilson coefficient times v squared over lambda squared that's hidden in this notation, then you get very weak constraints on one parameter simply because you have a highly correlated fit space. Cancellations can happen, not a big surprise, weak constraints can be placed. And you don't get much out of thinking about the theory error changing in the EFT because it's already so weakly constrained. If you notice you have some sensitivity, you want to be selected for things that are large here. But if you want to impose that you can never have a correlated power counting violation to lead to that lead to those sort of solutions, then you get the same sort of thing grouped around zero. Not that exciting, but that's how it actually works. Now, what you can't see, for some reason projectors in Canada can never show this. Toronto, they couldn't see this either. But you can't see it, but there is a very, very, very small green line. And trust me, if you could see it, it'd be really visually stunning. But there's a very small green band here around plus minus one. Okay, and this is some combination of the data. These are just individual coefficients. That green band is this green band. The same size, the scale has changed that much. And you can't see it here either. What is up with you guys? This is the same problem. I mean, is this like a deficiency of Canadian projectors? This is the exact same problem at Toronto. Anyways, it's very impressive, trust me. There's this green band that goes like this from plus minus one, and this is what you get for the Wilson coefficients if you only have one at a time. So it gives you an idea of if you have only one at a time and no cancellations, you're changing things by multiple orders of magnitude. So when you're interpreting the same set of data and projecting it into these Wilson coefficients, that's the difference that you're getting depending on these assumptions you're making of having multiple parameters there or not. And so if you go further and you also have what this is not the individual Wilson coefficients, this is combinations of parameters in the mass eigenstate Lagrangian, the effective coupling of leptons to
axial coupling of leptons, axial coupling of leptons, neutrino coupling, and then this is a four lepton operator. You also get things which are very similar to no cancellations allowed. So some people do these analyses and they want to use disto variables and they get very strong constraints. Other people do another one, get much weakly, much more weakly constrained results. And they yell at each other, but they're actually both right. And that's just the way of how they're choosing the parameterized game. But the thing is, there's actually stuff I don't have time to talk about. There's accidents in terms of the leptonic Z coupling. It actually is just the case that the leptonic Z coupling is such that it's suppressed compared to the naive expectation of the parent model. You get 1/2, and you minus 2 times the Weimer angle squared, and actually 1/4. And then you almost get a cancellation, and then you do perturbative corrections of that. In the standard model, you get this accident where the perturbative correction makes it even smaller. The cancellation is even better, it's just an accident. But that accident happens on the standard model prediction, so the standard model prediction is smaller than you would expect. And so the new physics effects are bigger than you would expect by not doing perturbative corrections for that reason. And that makes it that this is a little more strongly constrained than you might think would happen experimentally. So I think this is a bit of a fake as to how strongly constrained these parameters are, but they still are quite strongly constrained. I can explain that in more detail later.
So, sorry, are you still doing what you're saying? You're fixing everything else and just adding that parameter?
No, that's profiling, yeah. It's not marginalizing, it's profiling, but it means taking the derivative and taking the minimum of the. So it's basically allowing the. So it's like thinking of a multi dimensional space, it's going to the biggest part of the Boswell space, which allows maximum cancellation of parameters. You take derivatives of the parameters you're getting rid of, and then you feed them back in. So it's a bit different than marginalizing, which marginalizing you have to assume a prior sort of form. This, you just take derivatives and then feed it back in. You take the parameters, multi-dimensional prior space, and slice it down in a way that gives the maximum distance in each possible slice that you take to get down to the space that you have.
Why is that better than marginalizing?
I'm not a statistics Nazi, it's not. It's just a way to do it. Some people are sure it's better, but one case you have to choose a prior. Yes, exactly. So some people really hate marginalization because you have to assume a prior, and how do you define your metric on theory space? Good point. Other people hate profiling because it allows all these cancellations, and how do you know your UV physics will have that cancellation?
We're making choices either way, right?
I know! Do you get
errors or a small error of this, right?
It depends on what you were to choose in the marginalizing case for your prior.
Okay.
So the thing is, once you have this higher, this marginalization is kind of bad. If I was to be a little bit of Nazi, that's not what I mean to say, but there's some better way to say that. But if I was to be a little bit aligned with marginalization, then you could complain that, well, it's very highly correlated in the fixed space, and what if your marginalization, your prior, isn't allowed as cancellation? That's really bad. You might think that on a density of plot space, you're covering almost all the plot points, but the plot points that allow this cancellation are the most important ones.
Mm-hmm.
So that will be bad.
Not too bad. Okay, moving on. So this is just to show you, almost out of time. This is just to show you, we're at A and B and C, that 20 of 53 parameters are simultaneously constrained doing this. This is in some, so at Toronto, Eric Poppitz called this electric constraint data on steroids, and that's basically what this is. It's like when you really do the general case in this formalism, this is what you get. So it's nice to know that this is the answer in a theory which is probably an approximation for reality. And it'd be nice to even push this all the way to the full number of parameters. And that's what we're doing. We have another one, which is coming. We know how to do it, as of last week. So this, again, poorly projected, is just another way of thinking about this theory error. So these neglected perturbative corrections in dimension 8 corrections, if you look at what happens on the shift in the observable over the observable, the percentage level change of the observable, if you have a percent level measurement over a per mil level measurement, and then you look at what happens as a function of the cutoff scale, this should really be the cutoff scale divided by the square root of C, but we've just taken C to be 1, so don't get worked up about that. Then as lambda gets smaller, obviously when you neglect dimension 8 stuff, you're in trouble. And also when you neglect perturbative corrections, you can get into trouble. So that's kind of obvious. And this gives you an idea of when you're going below percent level measurements, which we have few measurements that go below percent level, but we have a couple, or even when we're starting to get into the percent level territory, you have to start to worry about dealing with these sorts of neglected corrections, because you can get an effect like this, and it can push you in the wrong direction in your fit space. If you're in the per mil region, this is below percent, And they have a bunch of measurements, a few at LEP like this, and at Pepitron like this, then you can just see that you want to think harder about how neglecting things actually affects your interpretation of the measurement. So let's think harder about one of them that's very precise in a second, but this is just the math corresponding to that. We're neglecting a whole bunch of stuff, interpretive corrections and various things, including dimension 8 operators. And you have multi-scale problems, so we're not summing all the logs, so you have logs like this hanging around the perturbative expansion. And when you're below 3 TV, or lambda over square root of C is below 3 TV, you need to start thinking about neglecting these effects beyond tree level. And that's not a region of theory space which is not interesting. That's the region of theory space where we would actually find deviations in this sort of formalism would be useful. So we should think hard about this. That's why we're working on it. Let's check MW out, because it just looks like it's got to be wrong. So you might at this point think, oh my god, this stuff is crazy, there's too many parameters. What the heck? Everything's wrong, every measurement's wrong, every interpretation of measurement's wrong. But actually, some things are robust when you generalize them into the from the standard model into the CFT, and other things are less robust. So it's kind of our job to distinguish those two. And one thing that's rather robust is the WMAS measurement, just because of some choices they made in the analysis. So it wasn't because of EFT thinking, but they actually made some smart choices. So how do you do the WMAS? This is a master's student who's going to Oxford now for his PhD who did this work. And what you do in a WMAS measurement is you basically singly produce a W at the Tevatron, decays into leptons, there's missing energy, so you can't reconstruct its mass peak easily. So then you have to basically use the fact that the initial state doesn't have missing energy, to use transverse variables, as is well known, and to use smart variables, and when you translate from the usual variables that you would use with the mass peak here, if you could reconstruct all these final states, into those transverse variables, you get a peak that happens in the Jacobian, hence it's called the Jacobian peak, in terms of this spectrum, which is in terms of MT here, this transverse mass curve that you can define. This is well known from the 80s. Now you can probably not see this very well, but there's a line here and some dots. And the line and the dots is what you do when you calculate this thing in tree level and perturbation theory. And then the dots are what you get experimentally when you do this reconstruction when you take out detector smearing for the blue. When the red is when you put in the detector smearing. Okay, so the effect of the Tevatron smearing out the states is a huge effect on these measurements. And what they do to define these measurements, to define what they quote for the WMAS, is to make a whole bunch of templates of this form for different values of the WMAS for the fixed value of the width. They then vary those WMAS measurements in very small increments, and then they look at the data and they see which one works, and then they define the error by how close they get. But what you need to worry about is the width is also there, right? So the changing the coupling here on the vertex, because of these higher dimensional operators, does that mess up your interpretation when you're trying to say how the pole is being shifted in the way you're thinking about this? So what you do is you basically need to do the generalization into the EFT, which we've done, and then you need to worry about the case where the width change is proportional to these couplings or not, that is defining this diagram, which is defining what you're measuring. So you can decompose the width in two parts. One is the part that is proportional to the normalization, these diagram couplings, and the other is the width effect that isn't proportional to this, some tau final state, which they're not using. The part that takes off here and causes such trouble and would have a huge bias on the measurement, that is the part that's proportional to the normalization of the data. That would cause a huge problem because they quote their experimental error as this. And these variations could easily be 2 to 3% which you take off. But if that happened, in some sense, they would already know because it would have had a bad fit. That's what this is showing with the iceberg. And if you have the other piece which is not proportional to the normalization in the data, it actually is well defined by their measurement. Now, this is not the reason they define their measurement error this way, which is this black band. But it actually turns out that it's good. The way they define their measurements, that they floated the normalization. So the experimenters, they thought about it, like, how the hell can we ever get a normalization to the precision of WMAS, which is a subset of the measurement? And they smartly said, well, let's not try. And they define a measurement around that, just getting the shape. And so things like this are robust. They go into the EFT and then interpretation quite easily. But other things are not robust. For example, the Z measurements, which are very precise and have these very strong constraints I was showing on some of those parameters. At one scale, measured at the Z pole, you have a constraint on this, which we can argue about because of periodic layers, but there's some constraint here. And at another scale, which is Higgs decay to two Zs, and one of those Zs has to be off shell, then you have a four Fermion operator feeding in with lepton components. There are points in the parameter space which are completely unconstrained, in these operators that feed in. And this is just one of the parameters that can sit here, and there's a whole bunch of them that sit here, like these 20 parameters. So there's a lot of effects of how when you change scales and you try and put together this information in a consistent picture, you get effects like this, which you have to worry about as a theoretical error if you're only doing tree-level calculations. So the right thing to do is just calculate beyond tree level. That's why we're doing that. Then you can push these theoretical errors below the experimental errors robustly, once we actually do the job, and everything's fine. But currently, as you go below percent level or a couple percent level measurements, you have to worry about this stuff. You have to look at each individual measurement and see if you're messing things up.
Are you talking about the SMEP or the actual standard model here?
The standard model theory error is just this.
Okay.
But there's an extra piece which I've been talking about, and I talked about in particular one of these for the WMAS, which turns out to be okay for this one. But there's an extra piece. And whether this extra piece is bigger than this error or not depends upon the cutoff scale, depends upon the UV. And scenarios we're interested in do not necessarily have, due to the neglect of one loop corrections or even dimension 8 operators,
so
such small contribution to that form.
Calculation for the estimate.
Yes.
Okay.
So let me show you one of them. I'm running out of time. Let me show you one. Okay, but that's why you want to do this. Okay, so that's why we're doing it, that's why other people are doing it. So to do that, you first have to have a different field theory. As I've been saying, the key point is that these are real field theories, and these theories have divergences. The divergence structure is different than the standard model. We know how to renormalize, but you really do first have to get the divergences under control. Now, the technical hurdle, which fell recently, in 2010, was them finally doing that non-redundant operator basis, that Warsaw basis thing I was pointing at before, Misiak and collaborators. Now that was done, in 2013, we were able to renormalize the whole thing at one loop. That actually happened, and it worked. Now, there are also some competitors, and Passerino did a renormalization program recently, which is a little bit more motivated of the TUF renormalization program for the standard model, but he also agrees using the Warsaw basis with some of our results. So we agree. So the point is, this has been done, the divergences are under control, so we can actually do these calculations. So you can actually see this. This is better than Toronto. So these diagrams are a whole bunch of diagrams.
We get that a lot.
Okay. Sorry, I guess they can see this too. In some ways. So anyways, but these dots are operator insertions. There's 59 operators. They don't all correspond to all diagrams, but there's a lot of redundancy in terms of the number of operators you can put in. We had to do all of these sorts of diagrams in order to get the divergences under control, but that actually happened. For example, here's the gamma-gamma renormalization group diagram, which is just four. And you know, you just calculated this in the unbroken phase of the theory. It's been done, it worked. The basis closed number normalization, Misiak and collaborators got it exactly right. Awesome job. It didn't have to work. It could have been that they made a mistake, but they got it right. But it's not just the number of diagrams, although I'm showing this to you to intimidate you, and you should be intimidated. This was a very hard calculation. But the point is, it matters what diagrams you have. So for example, this is a four fermion operator feeding into a diagram. What you get back in the divergences does not correspond to the basis you chose to start with. Reality does not care how you've chosen to parameterize this L6 terms in the Lagrangian. That's just a coordinate choice in some sense in your operator space. So you get back divergences which are not the same divergences that correspond to the basis you chose, and you have to map those back to the field theory basis that you chose. Now, when you do that, you get a ton of structure from diagrams like this because of the symmetry groups present in these divergences, in these penguin diagrams, and you have to Fierce back, and you get a ton of our answer is due to that. So just those two diagrams give a huge part of our answer, but that's an important part of the answer. The reason I want to emphasize that is not just to intimidate you, it's to get a important point across, which is that when you do that calculation and you think about the corresponding aspects of the calculation when you're doing the full one loop calculation, not just the divergences, it gets you to realize that these theories at the low scale, once you've integrated things at a couple TeV, what you actually see is quite shifted around by the equations of motion. You have highly reduced by the equation of motion field theories, which are not things we intuitionally are used to thinking about. The standard model has some equation of motion reduction you can do, but it's not the same in the sense of the way you reduce the number of interaction terms, because these dimension 6 operators, they're intrinsically local and low scale in terms of some of the interactions. So, anyways, it gets you to realize you have to think of it as a general EFT. You have to do the general case to really do the good job when you want to have some measurement projected into the CFT. So I guess I'll skip this. I'm running out of time. Well, I'll skip this. I'll just very briefly mention. When you want to do perturbative calculations like this in quantum field theory, the algorithm is well known, and you just extend the algorithm into the EFT, but some interesting things happen when you do that. So you basically choose some input parameters, canonically normalize the field theory, and then make predictions. But you now have shifts, for example, of the Z mass or the W mass due to these higher dimensional operators, which you have to take into account with linear expansions. But it's not that big a deal. You can do it. You can do it at leading order. It's hard, but we've done, say, this 177 observable thing. But if next to leading order, then you want to do this at one loop. So you want to go expand on the Bevel one loop, you want to quantum normalize one loop, you want to relate your input parameter measurements to these Lagrange parameters at one loop. That's really hard, but that can also be done in a direct kind of algorithmic way. It's just you don't want to be stuck with something where you have to choose one gauge. So I was talking in the clip about this. There's some intense discussions about whether or not you want a student to use a formalism that is stuck with one particular gauge choice. And that's the reason that some of us don't want to do that. I want to have a gauge-independent formalism of this form. So let me just show you, for Higgs v gamma gamma to finish, what actually happens here. So let's say you actually measured a Higgs v gamma gamma next week or in a couple of months or a year from now that deviated from the standard model. So what that would mean is they've measured a ratio of this mu parameter. So the expectation that the number of events in the gamma-gamma decay compared to the standard model deviated from what you expected. So there's an amplitude there that compared to the standard model is different than what you thought. At tree level, there's these three operators that feed in, that get the 16 pi squared enhancement because the standard model is loop level, and they sit there. But then you can also have one loop operators that come in. And they also could just be sitting there. There's 13 there. And some of them don't come in at, most of them don't come in at tree level. So that's these operators. The operators in and of themselves aren't that interesting, other than there's different operator structures that come in at one loop that aren't necessarily there at tree level. So you can just calculate this thing at one loop. So what you do, and the reason you do this again is to robustly cover all cases where there's various hierarchies between these Wilson coefficients, because you just don't know what the UV is, and you want to cover these cases robustly. Yep.
Depends on how big lambda is.
Of course, it strongly depends on how big lambda is, but we don't know.
I can choose lambda to be, if I get zero.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely.
So what prediction is this? What's predicting?
You'll see, but it strongly depends on lambda, absolutely. But we don't know what lambda is. If any of this is useful, lambda is not too big. It, 1, 2, 3 TeV, but PDF suppression at LHC makes it hard to see states that are that massive. So it's not a vacuous thing. I mean, make it clear, I'll show you the number of how it affects things. But it totally depends. That's the whole point. We want to cover all cases where lambda is reasonably bigger than the metric scale up to the decoupling regime we're talking about. So anyways, these operators that come in at tree level, the three of them, you can just write down the normalization matrix, you get it, and then this from RG plus 2 snow. And then you have to calculate a bunch of two-point function stuff to do with the standard model. The Higgs two-point function, the photon, and you have to define about the charge in one loop. If you do something smart with the background field method, this makes it much easier because you relate counterterms. It's a really good thing. And you get relationships between, for example, the Higgs wave function normalization and this combination of Bev normalizations and the background field method. You're just doing diagrams like this. These are not the diagrams in RD, they're slightly different. But you're just doing diagrams with insertions of the higher dimensional operators. It's a straightforward thing to do in perturbation theory, but it's just a little technically challenging. The one interesting thing I want to say, finishing, is this. Note that all of these counterterms come in proportional to B. Okay, so these subtractions proportional to B. And there was a mystery that popped up that confused us, which is pretty cool, in terms of the divergences that you actually obtain. So this gives you divergences proportional to B. This is divergence proportional to V. You have to define the Bev correctly, and when you do that, you combine it with the two-point functions, you use LSD, it all works, everything's fine. You get a cancellation that happens because of the word identity, which is kind of nice. And the two-point function in the Higgs, this is all standard model stuff. But then you get these divergences. So at some point, the graduate student comes to you and says, well, what about these diagrams?
And then panic ensues, because these are divergences proportional to V squared. So how is that possibly dealt with? It's actually cool that what actually is the solution to this is you have to think of this field theory as a field theory that is a real generalization. It's a real theory in and of itself. And you have to rethink gauge fixing in this theory. So tough gauge fixing is just still this gauge fixing term in terms of the background field, which is these hats. This is how it's done. But what you mean by the W field, which is the mass of W propagating state, what you mean by a Z field or an A field changes depending on these higher dimensional operators. They redefine the Weinberg angle, for example, proportional to V squared at true level. And so when you take this and you expand out, what happens, which is super cool, I thought, and then I've been told people already knew it, is when you get your Fedotopka of Lagrangian and you do your variations, you actually find that this thing generates ghosts. You get dimension six operators that are sourcing ghosts in these diagrams, exactly what you need to cancel those V-squared divergences, so it works. But it's really cool that gauge fixing in and of itself in a theory which is an effective theory with spontaneously broken symmetry is an interesting beast which has some interesting different structure than the standard model. So there's accidents in the way Kuf gauge fixing is built. So you have a C parameter for the B fields and the W fields, and if you just choose them to be the same but any value in Kuf gauge fixing, you lose this compact operator. But that doesn't happen now with these higher dimensional operator corrections. It's just an example of some structure that's there. And Tuff's brilliance was to build this thing in so we all just, you know, it's underneath our feet and we don't even know about it, and it's just working. But there's problems like this that appear when you have the EFT, which we then have to rethink, which is pretty cool in terms of the effective field. So I'm over time, so let me just say that the final result is known. It's there in all its glory. There's renormalization prediction, fixed finite terms, logs that aren't so large, finite terms. There's some interesting beasts like this. You get dependence on operators that don't have corresponding logs. You get pure finite terms, which is cool. And then we have the full result given here. And let me just get to John's question, and then I'm actually done. See, look, six. So do we care? Well, I care. I don't know if you care. But you should care. And I think you should care for the following reason. So look at the current measurements from run one, Atlas and CMS. For these rescaled Higgs to gamma gamma couplings, they are 0.93 plus or minus about 30-20% errors. Okay, but if you actually take these guys and take the square root and such to get the deviations that you're constraining on the Wilson coefficients, you get a limit like this from current data. And this is a b squared over lambda squared, but this has the tree level and then the one loop guys. So you're constraining this, and how wrong are you if you just say, I don't care, I didn't know, everything's just tree level, and you interpret it in this way versus this. So the difference between the two things and what you get, the naive map to the tree level C is corrected by these values. And it does strongly depend on lambda. So C's are order one here. You can think of this as C over square root, or lambda over square root of C. This, notice, doesn't start at 750 GeV, but we could have started there. And you get a 30% change from current data, 52% change from this low scale. But that's pretty low. That's at the, you know, the margin of where you want to do this expansion. It's still like a 10% power counting expansion, which is great for B physics and such, but it's still marginal. But as you go to high lambdas, it doesn't matter. It just decouples. You get the couple percent level change. But the point is that's with current precision. So like the Z to lepton case, if this thing gets down to a couple percent level precision, which people are arguing is going to be the case, say 4.5% or 3% or 2% for some long-term thing, this is high luminosity. See, I don't really believe this number, but it is a number people quote. And you look at the same analysis and see how wrong you are depending on the cutoff scale, you can see that if you're trying to do precision physics in terms of this EFT, when the cutoff scale is not just intrinsically assumed to be much larger than the machine energy, and these machines don't run at high energy, they run at high luminosity, at least these guys, or much higher energy, you're just getting it wrong. And you want to basically be able to close the window and get it right for the cases where the deviations are quite significant from what you would expect naively. So that's why we're doing this. I think it's worth doing, and I think it's actually necessary to do this sort of thing. So that's the one loop result for gamma gamma. That's this hardworking graduate student who's now graduated. And I also showed you some other hardworking results from some other graduate students. One of them is going to graduate this fall. And there's some overlapping results for gamma gamma with the Passerino, and we do agree. And it builds on the RG. And I think this matters when you get down to a couple percent experimentally. We already have some measurements, only a few, which are below that if you want to interpret an EFT. But there are a couple things like gamma gamma, which will get there in longer term LHCs. That's why we're doing this sort of thing. And I should say, we were not the first people to do one loop calculations like this. This is actually the first paper I know of doing it for this form in a complete way. It's a significant result for mu e gamma, but for obvious reasons. But now, this last year, you'll start to see that people are just doing this. And this is, needs to be done, and it's just happening. This will just happen for the next couple of years. In the field, there was a paper a week ago. There's another paper 2 days ago. People are just doing this. This is the reason that it's being done. So, and when we get together and talk about it and yell at each other, that's it with this conference. So if you're interested in this at all, we actually have this conference this fall. And I'm done. Sorry I'm over the time. And you can also see cool buildings and ships and nice things at Coke.
So is the conference in one of those boats?
No. But at MBI. So other questions? Yes.
So one thing I didn't, I guess I'm confused about this. But the reason we like your normalizable theory is that you have a finite number of couple and constants.
Yeah.
And that's enough to renormalize.
That's the old reason.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, so I thought that is the reason, even
well,
the new reason.
I mean,
that.
So if the sentence that was going to follow, which I didn't say, so don't let me put words in your mouth, if you then say that therefore you don't have any creativity when you have proper normalizable theory, that sentence would be really bad and really wrong.
Well, no, but I mean, it is a predictive theory, but I mean, I think it has its limits, and the point is...
Yeah, it does have limits because of power management.
Okay, so that's what I'm confused about. So you take your effective field theory, and then you do one-loop calculations in it, right?
Yes.
So shouldn't you then need new coupling constants, basically, to do one-loop? Because, I mean, the thing is, my impression was that the more loops you want to consider, the more coupling constant you have to...
No, effective field theories are better than that. So that RD program that we did, we proved. So at each order in the Carpani, we've written down everything consistent with the symmetries and then reduced by the equation's motion to a minimal basis, then loops do not introduce other interaction terms. So if you normalizable order by order, it's finite number of terms in normalizable order. There's a large number of coupling constants, but it's finite. And that's what we proved, which was non-trivial, that it was so hard for them to get the dimension six operator basis to actually even be defined. It could have been that there was still a mistake and that things wouldn't close on normalization. We kind of assumed it was going to work because Miss Gap is awesome, right? So it did work. So but that was non-trivial that that check actually worked.
So
that closed on normalization. Now, to be fair, or unfair, maybe, it could be that it's just an accident closing on normalization by some miracle, and then at two loops, maybe they did something wrong and you start to see that. I don't think so. I think it's fine. I think that this operator basis is well defined.
But I think there is a finite number of times, it's just that. I feel
you've got one loop corrections due to lower order in EFT would need to come alongside with three level at higher order in EFT.
You do, and that's part of what people are also working on. And that's a big problem or a big opportunity in terms of there's different regions. Let me show you this picture.
So you're exactly right. And that's why I was saying this theory error metric is a combination of perturbative corrections that are missing and the dimension 8 operators. For very low cutoff scale, it's totally dominated by dimension 8 operators. So like when you're down here, this takeoff is due to dimension 8 operators you're neglecting. But there's intermediate regions. So like the difference between this curve and this curve is different perturbative corrections.
Okay.
Cool. So there's regions of parameter space where you still want to know the dimension 8 operators, but the perturbative corrections matter a little bit more. And these sort of mass scales, you might think, well, who cares? But you should care a lot because this is the sort of mass scales that you're pointed to by the hierarchy problem, right? So it's a loop factor above the Higgs mass. So it's very reasonable to think that this is an interesting region to actually have physics beyond the standard model that's hard to see in the experiment. Yes.
Indeed.
But
you increase lambda.
Yes.
The corrections get smaller and smaller.
Absolutely. Yes.
So when you get to 3 TeV, 10 TeV, the Higgs mass hierarchy problem becomes grotesque.
Yes. Yes, that's why we hope that we'll actually find something. And
so,
that this will not be a vacuous exercise of people calculating very hard and getting gray hair for no reason.
So this, there's something wrong with the whole thing.
No.
Yes.
What's wrong with the whole thing? If you have a physics beyond the standard
model, square 10 TeV, divide by the Higgs mass experimental.
Yeah.
That's obviously something wrong, okay?
But we're not going, this is all based on the hope that it's
3 TeV squared.
Sounds like it might be an offline question. I have a really concrete one for slide 60. I just want to understand.
Remember slide 60.
I just want to remember. So I want to get your take home message. So your very last message was.
Oh, it is.
Was
Which 60?
60, yeah, that's right. So I want to understand, what do these brackets mean?
This is just the range of differences in the conclusion. If you look at the tree level interpretation of the result, and then you correct it by this, how much it changes, which is projected on a tree level. And it's just, it varies from this value for low cutoff scales up to this value for higher cutoff scales.
So the way I should think of this is that you had some sort of an error on kappa.
Right.
And then the 29% is, I take your C, gamma, gamma, and the error.
Yeah, so as this measurement gets more precise, you project at tree level onto just what's there at tree level operators.
Okay.
How wrong are you in what you thought you learned by this neglected correction?
In fact, I had cancellations at loop level.
Yeah.
So down here, is this a percent of what I thought the error had been, or this is
right? So if you then take, all you do is you take this precision, you do the exact, this number goes down, and you project on a tree level what you think, and then you look at how wrong you are for these operators when you vary them with C being order of one,
right?
And you just diagnostic this variation around. And then you see you're much longer, and it's just a matter of
so
the intrinsic size.
Much longer means that the errors out of the range that C I would have allowed are really should be 167% times what they would have been if I had interpreted.
That's one interpretation. Yeah, you can interpret it that way, but you have to be a little more careful because this is just giving you an idea of basically how precise measurements have to get before loop correctors can start to come in and give you a size of that deviation, thinking about it, right? And yet, if you were to make the measurement at a scale, so the purely iffy thing to do is to not have the logs in this loop correction, to define the parameter at the low scale as absorbing those logs, and then to do this sort of thing, have the finite term shift what you thought, and then run the theory from the low scale up to the high scale, and then basically get the exact same thing. But that's the two steps you should do. We're just doing both steps at once because we're normalizing the theory at the high scale. So there's also log lambda dependence as well as the 1 over lambda squared dependence because we're putting those two steps together. But those are the two steps you would do. You would absorb all those terms into the parameters. And so you can ask the question, and if you were to take the experimental measurement and then state, what did I learn at the scale lambda, the cutoff scale of the theory, when I matched onto the tree-level operators, and then I did those two steps, what would be the difference in what I thought I learned versus what I actually learned when I had these other parameters around? That's another way of this is what those numbers mean.
So the thing is, just make sure I understand it.
Yeah.
So if I made the naive inference, then you're saying there's a factor of 5.
You can be wrong depending upon what the other C values are by a factor of 5 at the cutoff score you've matched and what you thought you learned.
So that's 5 times that error,
the error, right?
Yeah, that's how wrong you would be compared to the tree level value. So yeah, it's a factor of 5.
Yeah.
So I think it's almost you seem to be learning all the other C if there's nothing new.
No, that's not what we're learning. We're learning that there's decoupling to some degree, and that EFT is already predicted.
This is what we see just the case.
Well, no, we see a 0 plus scalar, which has properties roughly consistent with taking 30% level, as I showed this stuff.
Okay. You see no new positive.
So far, yes, that's true. Yeah.
So we're confronted with the H-mass hierarchy problem.
Yeah, but if there's a solution and we're not able to guess it and it's hard to probe experimentally robustly into the sector that actually deals with the hierarchy problem, this is what we do. Until you learn more experimentally.
But we don't know how to solve the problem.
No, but it's likely that
there is no problem if it really lambda is a TEV.
Yeah.
Is there two TEVs or is there really that big a hierarchy there?
That's a loop factor, like 2.5 TEVs or something. Accent's just shot up.
Sorry,
I'm
about
that. Do you have any examples where this helps isolate where to look for new physics? So the implication is always, if there is new physics, then we're going to apply this formalism. But does this help search for new physics?
It is the, if there is physics beyond the standard model and there's a cutoff scale, then this is the field theory to interpret these lower scale measurements, or the half one. It's one of the two. And the standard model is the wrong theory because there is a cutoff scale, there are higher dimensional operators, and this is the right way to project the data into the field theory. That's a very strong statement, but that's actually true.
So that I appreciate, and it's very nice technically. And we should definitely do this, but I can just calculate in lambda goes to infinity and compare it to experiment, and eventually hope for an anomaly. And once I see that, then I'll think harder.
That we can play that. That's not a game, really. That's a huge, very serious scientific effort which other people are doing, right? And that is totally what you should do.
But you have you have a model space and a parameter space. I'm wondering if your parameter space helps look for places that haven't been looked at.
Let me first address the earlier point you mentioned, which is that you can just do this. Absolutely. You can do it up to the day, up to the nanosecond before the experimentalist announced deviation, which is actually deviation. And then the nanosecond after, when you want to interpret that, this is what you should be doing. If it's terms of local contact operator, deviation is not a long distance propagating state. So you want to have this ready before you actually find the deviation, and I think that's pretty obvious, right? But whether this helps you know which way you're looking for parameter space, in some sense, yes, right? So I'll show you what these fits. So when you do STU and you do this sort of minimal restricted sort of thing, you get one picture in your mind about how physics beyond a standard model has to look. And it actually turns out for STU that that's highly biased by the assumptions that you put into the analysis. Once you have a zero plus scalar in the spectrum, your conclusions for the Roman op parameters change a lot because it's not just one operator anymore, especially when you're looking at tree level. So it does actually open up that you could possibly build models where cancellations like this are happening so you get these weaker constraints. Whether that's interesting from a model builder perspective, I'm not a model builder, but there are windows of opportunity to do that sort of thing, which you only know once you start doing these sort of general analysis. But I think part of the reason this stuff wasn't done in the 80s and already completely done is SUSY types and these sorts of things. For them, remember they put in things like parity, or they put the R symmetry and these sorts of things. So things couple in pairs. So they're getting like an extra loop factor for lots of these guys. They don't have a lot of tree level matchings. So that makes things even smaller. And your best hope is to pair these directly produce the things, right? But that's one case, that's not all the possible cases. When you do partial compositeness, you have these linear operators that actually do true level matchings and have bigger effects, strong. A lot of this stuff is really motivated with strong interaction, sort of underlying scenarios for composite Higgses. But it's not just that, it covers all cases, but you can clearly motivate more clearly for UV matchings, which actually are interesting in the case where it's not some weakly coupled, parity protected theory physics beyond the standard model.
So in limb direct detection, there's a lot of discussion about what operator basis to use and how
experimental is it, like the dark matter stuff?
Should present their results. Limb direct detection.
Yeah.
And there's a more canonical basis that you're putting forward here because you're not dealing with
But we don't
fields,
have any other states
but,
of that form.
What are you asking the experimentalists to do, and are they doing that?
Look, I'm being recorded. It turns out that there's actually debates in this area as well.
Are you being recorded?
I hope not. Good. Then great. And I can see whatever I want. So there are huge debates, huge fights ongoing in terms of how to parameterize physics beyond standard model and this sort of thing. There are people that will tell you with a straight face, despite this talk, next to the unit corrections never matter.
So what are you saying?
If you they obviously do. So if you think that they matter or not, if you think that, so basically people have in mind that this is UV assumptions. And it's not unreasonable to think that the scale of new physics, considering what we currently know, is 5 TeV. And it's true, or even 10 TeV. And if you're out there, then you're decoupling. And it's true that everything gets small, and these corrections are small and less interesting. It's also possible and motivated as well by the hierarchy problem that it could be in the couple TV range. That is not robustly ruled out experimentally. If you think it is, you're just wrong. I mean, it is not ruled out robustly experimentally because of the way we actually search for things at colliders and the uncertainties that are involved with such high mass scales. So that case is not ruled out. And if we want to have a formalism that captures that possibility, in particular on the measurements that we can make very precisely, so the poles, things like the Higgs pole, Higgs to gamma gamma, if we're going to have a tough time digging out the direct signature of those sorts of states,
then it is reasonable to think that a very important source of information in the future will be these other measurements, these more precise measurements that we have under better control at lower energy scales. And there, the Higgs mass is just the Higgs mass, right? That energy going through that decay is 125 GeV, and so local contact operators are a good approximation to a state which is 2.5 GeV in terms of how it affects and actually affects that decay. And that just is the case, right? So that information is useful, and we want to incorporate that, and we want to project deviations or no deviations into the EFT in a consistent fashion, and that's exactly why we do this sort of thing. It actually makes sense. The only thing that surprises me is, why isn't everyone doing this? Why aren't you doing this?
Yeah,
that's the reason. But not as well as this.
That's true.
Yeah.
You know, there used to be a time eons ago when definition by Tyson, normalizable theory, is that the ultimate results are independent of the cutoff.
Mm-hmm.
That's the definition of normalization, which is obviously not true here.
Yeah, there's a cutoff scale. It depends a lot what the scale of this is, what you want to calculate. That's just the case.
So we've left QED. All of this is correct.
I have a shot on that, the rest of the room should be free.
I was going to say, Cliff was going to say that this is not the cutoff.
Yes, I
do. I know, but it's the max scale.
Just a simple document.
So why don't we release the room? Those are the questions, and we'll be comfortable with it.